started in the beginning like this. Is it working now? Is it turning?
Yeah.
Okay, start in the beginning.
Yeah, I showed you this. I give you these two pictures because
yes.
I think they will both interest your audience.
Yes.
And one is one of the few pictures of the grown man before he fell sick, because he had only very few years of healthy adult life. When he came out of the war, that was in 1918, and in 1921, latest, his illness began.
What kind of illness did he have?
What they call now Lou Gehrig's disease.
Was it a blood disease?
No, it's a brain disease. It's a deterioration of all the, not a brain disease. It's little like multiple sclerosis, only much worse, so. And you may have seen in the Exponent last week a report on the Einstein Memorial Service in Princeton, where a physicist who continues Einstein's work brought a paper which was obviously one of the most important papers of the conference, because he could not give it himself because he had to have it read. He has the same disease. It is I cut it out. You might be. That will give you an idea. And I think the best thing is if I now don't talk too much about my memories of him.
The voice you hear now is the voice of Dr. Gertrude Haller, a very dear friend.
Interruption. Leave the doctor.
Who was a contemporary of Franz Rosenzweig. The voice you will hear now again is Gertrude Haller's voice and her own experiences with Rosenzweig.
And I were rather close to him for quite a number of years. Franz Rosenzweig was the only child of a well-to-do, rather assimilated Jewish family, the upper middle class population of the town of Kassel. He was an extremely gifted child and young man, brilliant in many ways. He interrupted for a moment. What I of a man who must be counted among the great personalities in modern Jewry, Hans Rosenzweig. I consider it my duty and my privilege to say a few words in his memory, because both my late husband and I knew him personally and belonged to the circle of his friends. The name Franz Rosenzweig is well known to Jewish and Christian philosophers and students of religion because of his important writings and of his influence on generations of young people during his lifetime in Germany and posthumously in America. He deserves to be commemorated by every Jew who is concerned about the survival of Judaism in the world of today, and because of his personality and his unique life. Franz Rosenzweig was born in 1886 as the only child of an upper middle class family of great wealth, intense cultural interests, a strong social consciousness, and an unquestioned identification with the Jewish community. He was intellectually brilliant, artistically and musically gifted, and had a strong-willed, captivating personality. But beginning with adolescence, He was made restless by a lack of inner directedness. He switched at the university from subject to subject, medicine, science, philosophy, history. His brilliant intellect mastered all these studies, but they did not satisfy his inner searching. So he tried to turn to religion, but the little liberal form of Judaism in his parents' home and the local synagogue left him frustrated, as the superficial Jewish instruction had done in school. Under the influence of close friends who had embraced Christianity with a fervor which was very much similar to that of the Jewish followers of Jesus in Jesus' lifetime. After endless discussion with them, Franz Rosenzweig came very close to converting himself. But something subconscious kept him back. Maybe it was an heritage from his forebears, which had been very actively Jewish. This held him back. He wanted to know real Judaism before deciding to leave it. For this purpose, he spent the whole Yom Kippur from Kol Nidre to Nanila in 1913 at a small Orthodox school in the east end of Berlin. This first step into a completely Jewish world shook him to the core of his being. He realized that he did not have to embrace an alien creed in order to satisfy his yearning, that he had been about to abandon what he had not known to be his very own. Conversion, he told his mother, is no longer necessary and therefore no longer possible. As a natural and indispensable consequence, he resolved to put himself under the law and to devote his life to a twofold goal. He would himself learn in the traditional Jewish way of learning, and he would work for a better Jewish education of children and adults. With the energy and impatience, which was very characteristic of him altogether, he started immediately in both directions. And not even the outbreak of World War I in the summer of 1914 could deter him from his goals. Though Rosenzweig spent practically the entire 4 years of the war at the front as a meal nurse in Belgium first, and then mainly as an anti-aircraft gunner in the high mountains of the Balkans. Neither the rigors and monotony of army life nor fear of death could deter him from studying, thinking, and writing. On the contrary, it seems as if the regular daily routine of his military duties, the invigorating, stop it for a moment, mountain air, and the absence of all distractions had strengthened him in mind and body to such a degree that without the help of reference books, teachers, or congenial discussions, he produced in these years the first draft of his writings on the relationship of Judaism and Christianity, his plans for Jewish education and for teacher training, and above all, what he called the germ cell of his main work, The Star of Redemption. The letter on army postcards, which he sent for safekeeping to his mother. his. "What a correspondence that fellow has," said the other soldiers. "Contacts with the Sephardic Jews in Macedonia and with Polish Jews in Warsaw made deep and lasting impressions on him, as shown in his letters. In many ways, the war years can be looked upon as the years which concluded Rosenzweig's education and his preparation for the life and the responsibility of the adult man. Immediately after Rosenzweig's discharge from the army, this life started in the most promising way. It is as if everything was coming his way. He put the finishing touches on the star, this hard-to-read book on philosophy and theology, Judaism and Christianity, the individual and the community, life and death. It uses a new method of thinking and a language all his own. It found a publisher immediately. Almost simultaneously, Rosenzweig's doctoral thesis on the role of the philosopher in a militaristic state was accepted, and his professor invited him to start on an academic career. But he declined this most flattering offer because it would interfere with his decision to lead an entirely Jewish life. "I cannot serve two masters," he said in a letter to his professor. Instead, he accepted enthusiastically an offer from the Frankfurt Jewish community to become the director of their adult education program, promising him the freedom to remodel it according to his own ideas and ideals, and a liberal enough budget to engage competent teachers. He used both to create the Institute of Free Jewish Learning, for which he had tried to interest the Jewish leadership in many printed pamphlets and personal letters for years. He modeled it loosely as a modern form of the medieval Beta Midrash, in which the teachers did not lecture and the students did not passively listen, but where all learned with and from one another. This Freie Jüdische Lehrhaus became an immediate success in Frankfurt and was imitated in most Jewish community in pre-Hitler Germany. Its influence and even the name can still be traced in Jewish education and in Israel and the diaspora, including America. And last not least, Rosenzweig married. He married a girl whom he could have found, as he wrote to my husband, but did not marry years earlier, and who was glad to provide the kosher household and share life according to the halachic commandments which he wanted and felt he could lead without giving up his theoretical adherence to Jewish liberalism. Thus everything seemed to fall into place and to lead him in the direction to which the last words of the star had guided him, into life. Rosenzweig looked forward to many active years in which his theories would pass the test of realization, to life of continued Jewish learning under the best authorities and of increased service to the Jewish community. and best of all, to a life of marital and domestic happiness enhanced by the prospect of fatherhood. He did not want to write any more books until, as an old man, he would feel justified to compile a kind of modern Shulchan Aruch which would dissolve the apparent discrepancy between halacha and life in the modern world, as well as that of his personal attempt to combine orthodox practice with liberal thought. But that was not to be. After only 2 short years, Rosenzweig began to notice increasing difficulties in speaking, walking, swallowing, and even breathing and writing. These symptoms were soon diagnosed as the beginning of the same crippling disease which killed Lou Gehrig. Medical science had no cure. The difficulties made in the beginning such rapid progress that he was not expected to live for more than months. It became, however, clear very soon that he would have a probably long period of increasing physical disability ahead of him, which, however, did not then and would never impair his mind. Rosenzweig accepted this fate without despair and without self-pity. He and his devoted wife concentrated their energy and their mental ability on designing and providing all the technical means and gadgets and the help they might need and all their spiritual strengths on the task not to let the difficulties, as Rosenzweig called his disabilities, get the better of them, and to create as normal a childhood as possible for their son, who was born about 1.5 year after the outbreak of the disease. It is not possible to tell here now how they did it and what it cost them in sorrow and pain and heartache. They succeeded, and these last 8 years of Rosenzweig's life became, in a sense, his most important ones. Truly a verification of the Jewish life which he had postulated in his writings. This attracted a number of young people, many of them university students, in search of their own Jewish identity. They came year after year, every Shabbat morning, to the Rosenzweig's modest attic apartment and held services in the book-lined living room in which Rosenzweig spent all his days, kept tied to a high-backed armchair. He participated almost to the last day of his life. There was always Minyan, but of course the membership of the group changed constantly. Some of the members are today quite well known, as for instance Abraham Heschel, Erich Fromm, Ernst Simon, Nahum Glatzer. On weekdays there was an almost constant stream of visitors, many of whom were not close friends and relatives, and who did not just want to perform the mitzvah of visiting the sick, but who came to discuss philosophical and theological problems. Among them were probably as many believing Christians as Jews. Some of these visitors were or became quite famous, as Martin Buber, with whom he started a new translation of the Bible into German, Leo Beck, the foremost German rabbi, who conferred on Rosenzweig the title of Moreno, our teacher, Hannah Rovina, the star actress of the Hebrew theater, Habima. His disabilities, of course, forced Rosenzweig to return to the writing of books, which he had forsworn in the first exuberance of influencing people in direct personal contact. And again, as in the war years, his stubborn energy refused to take adverse circumstances into account. Neither his own disabilities nor the exhaustion of his ailing wife, without whose support he would have been a helpless cripple. In this way, he managed not only to maintain an enormous correspondence, but he also wrote and published a long line of books, articles, and reviews of importance. He concentrated on translating from Hebrew into German because he wanted to reach especially the assimilated Jews who knew no or little Hebrew. The above-mentioned translation of the Bible was undertaken to replace the popular translation by Martin Luther, which was widely used by Jews with one which did more justice to the Hebrew language and the fundamental Jewish character of the Bible. Rosenzweig worked on it until his last day and finished the translation of Isaiah. He translated further 60 hymns of the Spanish Jewish poet Yehuda Halevi and published them with an epilogue and copious notes. Among the many essays and articles which he wrote, in addition, perhaps the most important is the preface to the collected Jewish writings of Hermann Kohl, who had been Rosenzweig's teacher at the Jewish Institute of Instruction in Berlin. It is so important because it deals in depth with the problems which were so important for German Jews and perhaps are so important again for American Jews today, namely the question whether namely the relationship between philosophy and religion, and that between Judaism and Western culture. Rosenzweig's main concern, however, especially in the beginning of his illness, was whether his beloved Lehrhaus might die, or worse, might revert to the old unessential courses. He tried to save it by appointing his younger friend and disciple, my husband, as his substitute to run the institute under his close supervision, firm control, and according to his very definite directives. That worked out very well for almost 2 years, and the Lehrhaus flourished and grew as it had done under Rosenzweig's own directorship. But gradually, fundamental differences on the question of how to live and how to teach came to the fore, and attempts to discuss them freely and so to resolve them became so frustrating and painful that my husband felt it his duty to hand in his resignation and that it was accepted. It is to the everlasting credit of both men that they respected each other's standpoint and remained friends until the end of their lives, which came so tragically early to both. Rosenzweig died on December the 9th, 1929, 2 weeks before his 43rd birthday. The paralysis had reached the vital organs, and a cold leading to pneumonia ended his life. But his work did not die with him. The Lehrhaus survived in Frankfurt and other major Jewish communities in Germany, even into the first years of the Hitler era, and became the model for a number of similar institutes in America, England, and Israel. Rosenzweig's most important writings, even the difficult Star, were translated into Hebrew and English and thoroughly studied by Jewish and Christian scholars and students. The Star, for instance, became a textbook for the Judaic studies of major American universities. There is no doubt that Rosenzweig has had influence on the ecumenical attempts at understanding between the two religions. In the 50s and 60s, a veritable flood of books, essays, and articles swamped the book market, making a casual remark of Rosenzweig's that he did not expect to be known until 50 years after his death, almost into a prophetic prediction. Quite a few of these publications did not try any serious analysis of his system or did not enter into dialogue about his thesis. They concentrated on the man, romanticizing him as Baal Teshuvah and pitying him as a martyr. Nothing could have been less appropriate than this kind of hero worship for Rosenzweig, who berated relatives and friends with bitter sarcasm for similar attempts. He was no saint and no do-gooder. Basically, however, it is absolutely correct to focus the interest on the man and his life and not on his philosophical system and his theological teachings. For this I see two reasons. Rosenzweig verifies with his actions his ideas, brings them to life, and makes them visible for everybody, whether one understands his theories or not. He really does what perhaps Exodus 24:7 means when the Israelites say, after Moses has read the Ten Commandments to them, Na'aseh v'nishma, namely, we will do what the Lord commands, and then through doing we will understand. And perhaps more to the point, it seems that growing integration and assimilation into Western culture confronts American Jews with Jewish identity problems which are very similar to those which alienated so many educated German Jews in Rosenzweig's time and brought even him to the very brink.
now hear my friend Gertrude Hollow giving her life's experience on the Jewish scene in Germany in the 1920s and the personal relationship between Mrs. Hollow, her husband, and Franz Rosenzweig. The next voice you hear is Gertrude Hollow.
In order to give a true picture of what happened to Jews, and especially young Jews, in the 1920s, I have to go further back. And I must make something clear which may not be easy for Americans today to see clearly, that except for the Zionist movement, Zionism was very far from our consciousness. For us, the problem was our personal fight for Jewish identity, especially in view of the growing racist and anti-Jewish movements which preceded the Hitler years.
Were you ever part of the Zionist movement?
No. I even began very strongly, like many Jews in Germany, in a kind of hostile attitude towards Zionism, for two reasons. We could not accept the fact that we were not really, or could not really understand the fact that we were not considered as the Germans in the way we felt to be. We felt what is different between Germans in general and German Jews was the religion, and this we could and did talk out with German friends who were as much and as little Christian as we were Jewish. If this can explain it. But even more so, what held us back from embracing Zionism was that it came to us as not so much a Jewish movement, but as a British movement. The Balfour Declaration was given by what was at that time, not in the 20s, but before, at the bitter end of the First World War, the bitter enemy of Germany. And the first thing I, for instance, knew about the Balfour Declaration and Zionism was a flood of leaflets thrown by airplanes into German cities. Jews of Germany join the Zionist movement and get your own homeland. You are no longer welcome in Germany, in English language and as a war propaganda.
Were you aware in the early 20s, were you aware of the fact that you were excluded from the various Turkish movements like the Pfadfinder and other youth organizations?
To a certain degree, yes, but not in the way that we were excluded, but that young Jews wanted to be among themselves. And all this did not start in the 20s. In the 20s, this was a finished development when the whole youth movement in the modern sense started in England, but it came to Germany before the First World War in the form of Wandervögel and in the form of the most, I don't remember the other names, they were not so important. It was a movement back to nature, back to the enjoyment of nature, of hiking, and the simple life in opposition to the comfortable bourgeois life of the parents.
Do you remember any of the leaders of the Jewish movement, the Jewish youth movement?
I certainly do, and I come to that. But I must tell you that even the Zionist Jewish movement started out of the German youth movement, the Wandervogel Bewegung. And there was in 1913 a big meeting of all the youth groups with all the paraphernalia of being against the civilized bourgeois meeting. And in this
being against, can you explain that? I do not quite understand you. This big convention, it was against what? I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand.
It was, the convention was not against, what the feeling of the young people was, that they were caught in the lifestyle of their parents, which they rejected, in the way in which so many of today's youth rejects the comfortable bourgeois life of their parents, Jewish and non-Jews alike, and which drives today so many young people into the cults, drove the young people in Germany in the time of about 1905 or 6 or about that time up to the beginning of the First World War. And it culminated in this big movement on this big convention, the Hohe Meißner. Anybody who has gone through the youth movement here probably has heard this name too. And in this big convention, the beginning Jewish groups were involved too. It began as a special Jewish youth movement within the German youth movement. And gradually, partly due to the experiences of the First World War and the beginning racist undertone of the German movement, then came the split. And there were two different groups among the Jewish youth movement. One was the Zionist movement, the Blau-Weiß. They adopted the moved over and they adopted the blue and white colors and took it for their knee. And they were, and they were the first ones to really feel that the religion was not the only thing which divided or which separated the Jewish movement from the general German movements. And then there was the German-oriented group, the comrades, they called themselves, the Kameraden.
Was this a Jewish or a German movement?
It is a movement of the non-Zionist Jewish youth in Germany.
Were they accepted by their Christian counterpart as Germans?
That I couldn't tell you. They certainly were not accepted by the beginning racist German movement.
When do you think, was the racist movement strong as long back as you remember? Was the racist movement strong in 1913 already?
Not that I knew of. There was a racist movement, not so much among the youth, but among the grown-ups, as way back as the beginning 19th century. It started with an Englishman.
Chamberlain. Let's not go back.
So, and this had gone on and on. Yeah. And it found its first general acceptance, and it first came into public knowledge with Wagner.
Are you referring to Richard Wagner?
That was the beginning of the racist Teutonic movement.
And when do you think, which decade do you think this racist Teutonic movement started?
It became dangerous after the end of the First World War. And there were many, many causes who helped it along. The defeat in the war, the poverty, the inflation, the destruction of the economic basis for everything. And as usual, who can you blame? The Jews. And that was the nightstick which they held over us.
When do you think you or your husband when did you hear of Hitler first?
Well, we all heard of Hitler first when he published his Mein Kampf.
Then you didn't know, you didn't pay any importance to the fact that Hitler's march took place in Munich?
Oh yes. And we who were at the universities, we got to feel it first.
Where did you attend the university?
In Göttingen and in Munich. And of course you could not be in Munich without noticing what was going on. But still, we did not take it serious enough.
Do you remember anything about the so-called Soviet Republic of Bavaria?
Certainly, I even was on the Theresien Wiese when it was proclaimed. From sheer curiosity. But then I got afraid before they started the march through the city. And it is true that this movement, which raised the anger and the hate of not only the races, but of all anti-communist parts of the population, in which raised all the fears that there were Jews in leading positions.
Many Jews?
Quite a few. And not so many, but leading ones. And the ones who were the vocal ones. I still see Eisner, Kurt Eisner, standing under the big statue of the Bavaria on the Theresienwiese in Munich, and inside the thousands and thousands of people. I know relatively little of all these. I was involved during the last years in the university, in the student movements, especially under the leadership of Max Weber, the really founder of sociology, and who wrote very interesting and very important books on the sociology of religion, especially the Jewish religion, which he considered a pariah religion, and all this would be too far up. But when the real political movement started around 1920, I had just married, had one child after the other, was glad to help to know where our next meal would come from, and so on, to participate in any political actions.
Can you tell me, before you go too far now, could you tell me everything you know about the Free Corps and the destruction of the labor movement in Bavaria? Do you remember any of that? What did the Free Corps, what did they consist of? Who paid them? Who financed this? Who organized it? Who led it? Do you remember any of these things?
I remember a little of it. And this conquest of Munich, for instance.
Conquest by whom?
By the Free Corps, in which the leaders of the Räterepublik, that means the German Soviet Republic of Bavaria, were killed, namely Eisner and Landauer. The brother of my mother-in-law was the physician of this corps. So little was it at that time specifically anti-Jewish. The leaders knew it and meant it. But it was not really known in the public. It was the fight against the communist conquest of Germany, which never went further than Munich. And I was in Berlin, where I had my first job, when the Kapp-Putsch.
I was just going to ask you to tell me all you know about the Kapp-Putsch.
I lived through all these things, and now that you ask me, memories which I had completely forgotten
come back to you.
Tell me, the leader of the Kapuch finally wound up as a very harmless individual, a refugee in Sweden. What do you remember about the Kapuch?
What I remember is first that he pushed up the labor movement.
Who is he?
Kapp.
Kapp. You remember his first name?
No.
It doesn't matter.
No, I don't remember, yes. But I can easily look it up if it's of interest for you. And he then concentrated in the spring of 1920 on Berlin. And the first success he had was a general strike. Of all works, like we have them here, the whole city came to a standstill.
This was a strike against Kapp?
No, for him.
Or for Kapp?
Yeah, against the government, against the incredible and incredibly bad economic, social, political situation in Germany. It was the time when the inflation grew and grew. It's unbelievable for me just today that inflation can grow and grow in as it does in America now, and not only the fever and the scoundrels could live comfortably. We all were used to be so poor that very little else held room in our heads and in our lives.
Brother, in the books I studied about this period, there seems to be a consensus that the inflation was really very much desired by the big German industrial interests, because they were able to borrow money to finance their various undertakings, and they knew very well that they didn't have to pay this money back, because by the time the debentures became due,
yeah,
the debt was non-existent. So many of the authors seem to agree on the fact that the inflation was in the interest of big industry, big business. Do you feel that the same thing?
Is that so different from what we have now?
That's the question I was going to ask you. Is the inflation being helped along in America, by big American industry, would you say?
I think so, but it does not. It does not hit so hard, because thanks to the American credit system, everybody who has an American credit card or credit card of any kind profits in his little way for his consumer status, as the big conglomerates do it on a big scale. And that was not known in Germany of that time. And nobody would give credit for consumers.
In those days.
No. You had to pay cash.
Let's go back to the Kapuch.
Yeah.
Was this a military push?
Yes.
Were there any other well-known military figures of World War No. 1 involved? Was Ludendorff involved?
Yes, very strongly. I think Ludendorff, whether he was involved in the Kapusch especially, I don't know, because the Kapusch was concentrated much more in northern Germany, and Ludendorff lived in Bavaria. But he was definitely strongly involved in the, probably the military consultant of the Nazi movements in its early days.
When you read first about the Nazi movement, at that time, were there any of the figures who later accompanied Hitler in his rise to power and his conquest of Europe, were any of those figures, like Goering, Goebbels, were they part of the scene at that time?
Yes, yes.
Who?
Yes, both of them. Then another man by the name of Rosenblatt, the intellect, and he collected Jewish cult and cultural subjects for his Museum of the Jews. Quite a few of the property of the former Jewish congregations were saved this way.
They were that was in Strasbourg during the Second World War.
In Strasbourg and in Frankfurt, or near Frankfurt, I don't remember where it was.
When Hitler's putsch in Munich in 1923 failed, did the then existing Jewish leaders feel that the danger of this man had passed? Did you
Too much. Because far too few, and that includes me too, failed to really see the seriousness of the situation. And that is something which haunts me, because I have the feeling that the American Jews repeat much of this blindness and ostrich-like attitude. Too many still think it cannot happen here.
To which extent do you fault the Jews for the rise of Hitler? Do you feel that the Jews were too visible by being in the professions, doctors, lawyers, or by being wholesalers of farm produce? Where do you think was our biggest contribution to our destruction?
I used to think that it was what you just said. I have begun to think that I was mistaken in thinking so, regardless of what we did. We were blamed. As always. If you keep too much to yourself, you are blamed by those who hate you, and there are many. And if you try to be as everybody else, you still stick out like a sore thumb. Whatever we do,